The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order state and local government operations for farm technology and elections. The first bill members we have on the agenda is House File 222, Representative Swalick. Representative Swalick, I will move that House File 222 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. So Representative Swalick, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Kowalski and members. Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment.
Representative Swalick, is this the A2 amendment?
Yeah, H-O-222-A2.
I will move the A2 amendment, and members, let's put the amendment on and get the bill in order, and then we can speak to the bill as amended. So all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Swalick, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this bill is about campaigning in multiple dwelling units. It actually comes from Senator Sandy Pappas. We have worked on this bill once before, and I think if you're wondering sort of what the motivation is, it really is so that senators can campaign on the off years. So when they are not up for election, that they can also enter into apartment dwellings. So if you look at the bill, it's currently filed for election to public office, but it says if you have an organized campaign committee, it's permitted by state or federal law for the purpose of seeking election to a public office at the next general election to be held for that office, then you can campaign in apartments. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have a short testimony from Mr. Horner, who is also one of my constituents. So I'm glad to have him here this morning.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jack Horner, representing Minnesota Multi Housing Association. We support the bill. We appreciate working with the author, and think that it clarifies
actually
two or three different things that we think are good. So we do support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And any questions, of course, I'd be happy to respond.
Questions from the committee to the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair. Representative Swalick. On line 1.19 on the bill itself, obviously, the term nursing home, I'm wondering if we might want to expand it to assisted living facility or if that's broad enough or if we need to expand it a little bit to a broader definition of long-term care facilities.
Representative Swalick or Mr. Horner, I don't know which of you wants to address that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I was approached about that amendment probably about 2 minutes ago. It does make sense to me. I do not know the rules in your committee if we can amend things with an oral amendment at this point.
Representative Swalick, we certainly have the ability to amend the bill, but we will not amend it without a written amendment, and then we will have staff make sure that we all understand the amendment and that Mrs. Anderson has the amendment so that it can be incorporated into the minutes. So I'm going to go to Mr. Gehring, and he can explain, first of all, what that amendment would be, and then we'll have it in written form that we can act on it. So, Mr. Gehring, you want to explain what that amendment would be?
Mr. Chair, I guess I understand Representative Kalin right. I'm not sure which term he's supposed to use, if it's assisted living facility or long-term care facility. Okay, so the amendment would be page 1, line 19 of the bill. After nursing home, you'd insert or assisted living facility.
Mr. Chair, that would be my amendment.
Representative Kalin,
I'll move that amendment.
Okay, just so we understand, Mr. Gehring, you have the amendment?
Yes.
Members, everyone understand the amendment? Any discussion to it? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In previous life, I worked in public Minneapolis public housing, and they had some buildings there where they had split. You know, they had certain designated units that were assisted living, but they had 100 to 200 units in the building, but maybe 10 were assisted living. Would that, I guess maybe through the chair to Representative Kalin, would that be considered an assisted living building and then be denied, candidate denied access to the entire building.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think that would allow access to the entire building, but I'd have to, I wonder if there's someone from the public that might be willing to answer
that question. We have someone coming forward who may have an answer. If they wish to come forward and identify themselves for the record, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm here representing the care providers. We represent long-term care, assisted living folks, and we did approach Representative Slawick shortly before. Our concern is, and I'm not sure I can exactly answer your question, but our concern with why we wanted to add assisted living facilities is that it's always not the tidy little box that prepares, that allows folks to walk around and distribute the materials within an assisted living facility, but they do have multiple residents, as you point out. So what we wanted to do to try to facilitate what we believe is the spirit of the rule is to allow folks to distribute, but in those facilities where it would be, sometimes they have mailboxes, for example, in assisted living facilities where people can put stuff in the mailboxes. So we're just trying to make sure that this rule would apply and work for the assisted living facilities as well as the skilled nursing facilities.
Mr. Pearson, when did you approach Representative Slawick?
Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, I didn't approach her until about 5 minutes before the hearing.
And Mr. Pearson, this bill was introduced on January 22nd. It's been posted for a hearing for a week. And now we're doing an amendment on the fly where I'm not sure who understands what the language is that's being drafted. I'm going to repeat what I said yesterday. I would hope that everyone would take seriously the fact that a bill's been introduced, bill's been posted. If you have a concern, there are staff available to draft an amendment and talk to the author. But 5 minutes before the hearing is pushing it. So, Mr. Pearson, I respect your concern, but let's make sure we plan ahead. So, Representative Kalin, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Nelson might have had a question.
Representative Nelson.
Further.
Well, I guess it's my concern, is that I get a question I've had is, not only do I, like I said, I have this past experience, but I also have a large number of apartments in my, and one of them would probably be considered an assisted living facility, and I guess I'd be concerned about it restricting access. And a lot of the apartments do not have tidy mailboxes by the outside of their apartments to put the stuff on, whether they're assisted living or just regular apartments. I guess that I have problems with the language. I think I could agree with expanding it, but I think, like the chair said, putting it here on the fly, I don't think we're getting at what we want to get at. I think we're getting too broad with saying assisted living. I could see adding long-term care facilities, but I think the language needs to be worked on. I don't think, like I said, I've got concerns about it is as the amendment is stated.
Representative Slawick.
Mayor members, Representative Kalin, thank you for bringing this forward. And I've worked with Mr. Pearson before, and he generally does a great job. But being approached in the elevator on the way to the hearing, I think maybe, I think we should work on this. We can either vote it down, Representative Kalin, or we could pull it.
Representative Slawick, I'm going to have Mr. Gehring describe what this section of the bill actually deals with. And the intention of the amendment may not be to what the section of the bill actually deals with. So, Mr. Gehring, do you want to explain what this section of the bill deals with?
Mr. Chair, so this amendment proposed by Representative Kalin impacts the sentence that deals with leaving materials at a central location. So it wouldn't impact the ability of anybody to access a building or not access any particular type of building. It's just saying that if a candidate wants to leave materials, the manager of an assisted living facility could require the candidate to leave the materials at a central location in the building. So it's not affecting what they get in or don't get in.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is experience in my campaigning in my district with the apartments that I have, and I've had to bring copies of the law that allows us to be in there to even get access to the building. I've been denied access. I've had to go have the attorney general call and apartment managers. I've had situations where I've been campaigning and the manager's gone behind after I left it and picked up all the material and dumped it in the trash. And or even in my case had their maintenance staff go behind, and this was an apartment building, but pull the stuff out of the doors and throw it away so that we couldn't leave. I guess that's why I have a concern. I mean, that's my concern. I guess it's I understand the intent of the amendment and or the bill, and I think it's a good bill. I just got a concern of how we're going to, you know, possible problems in the future from experience I've had in the past.
So, Richard Nelson, you're speaking for the Kalin Amendment or against it?
Against the Kalin Amendment, 40 bill.
All right. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To the amendment.
To the amendment, Mr. Chair. So just a clarification, and I'll try and restate what I thought I heard, and if you could correct me, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate that. If we are amending on line 1.19, as I look at the beginning of that clause, Part B clause, it says a candidate and campaign workers obtaining access under this section. So if there is no ability to obtain access, they still couldn't leave the material anyway. So the whole key is in whether or not they can obtain access. So I think the amendment does not work place where it is. And Mr. Chair, is that your understanding as well?
Representative Biskins, I don't advocate for or against these bills. My job here is to facilitate this process. So I'm not going to advocate one way or another, but I will direct Mr. Gehring to answer your question because he is House Research. So let's have Mr. Gehring answer your question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, in paragraph A, line 1.9, it does allow access to a multiple unit facility used as a residence. And I guess I don't know practically how that's applied. But if a multi-unit facility used as a residence includes an assisted living facility, then I think a candidate would be able to access them, but it's not specified directly.
Representative Simon. Any further discussion to the Kalin Amendment? Representative Falk, I'm going to ask you again to state your position on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I think at this point we need to work on this. And so my position would be that I would be against it or prefer it withdrawn.
Representative Kalin, I'm going to ask you then, Representative Slawick, if I work on this, this is going to go to the floor. Does that mean we're going to now amend the bill on the floor?
Representative Pawlowski, of course it's hard for me to know at this point how to answer that, but I would say if you prefer and if you're all going to support it the way it is, then I can take it the way it is to the floor.
That's not my question, Representative Slawick. So the motion before us is to the Kalin Amendment. All those in favor of the Kalin Amendment signify by saying aye. All those in favor of the Kalin Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay.
No. No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. To the bill, Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would appreciate your support of this bill. It's been through the process before. I think it is good in that it opens up access for our senators during the years, and would appreciate your support.
Members, considering there are concerns with the bill, I'm going to lay this bill over for the next hearing, and if there are amendments that anyone wishes to bring forward, let's work from now until the next hearing to do so. So I'm laying the bill over. I'm not laying it on the table. I'm simply laying it over. And we will proceed to the next bill on the agenda, which is House File 255. Representative Slawick, House File 255. I will move that House File 255 be passed and placed on the General Register. Do you have an amendment to this bill, Representative Falk?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. It is the H-O-255-A-3.
The A-3 amendment?
Yes.
Members, I move the A-3 amendment, and out of courtesy to the author, I would hope that we would put the A3 amendment on, and then you would be able to address the bill as amended. So all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Slawik, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is one of those bills, members, that actually comes right from the local level. I have a test flyer here from Maplewood. What the bill does, it prohibits candidates, political committees, and political funds from using names susceptibly similar to names previously used by other candidates. This is a situation that did happen. The bill defines deceptive names as one that is a reasonable person would find deceptive or confusing. I would appreciate, Mr. Chair, members, if I could have testimony next, and he could tell you more about the situation.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Stephen Switzer. I'm a resident of Maplewood, and I'm the assistant to the board of the Maplewood Voters Coalition.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I have a short statement I'd like to read, if I may. So I don't
yes,
get
please.
Thank you. The Maplewood Voters Coalition is a voluntary association organized as a Minnesota political committee. We came together in 2006 to address the political situation in Maplewood. We were successful in our work during the 2007 campaign for Maplewood City Council and Roseville School Board members. By the way, Roseville School Board overlaps the western end of Maplewood. That's why we also concerned ourselves with that. But during that entire campaign and up to the present, the name of our political committee, the Maplewood Voters Coalition, was continuously attacked and tried to be denigrated. I've given you the details in a written statement in your packet, but I didn't think that I should use the committee's time to read all of that to you today about what actually happened to us during the campaign. Why I think this is important is that as American citizens, we've learned in the last few years that our identities are subject to theft. The whole idea of identity theft has become prominent, but that's usually referring to financial identity. But I think our experience says that our political identity is just as valuable to us and just as exposed to and vulnerable to that kind of attack of theft. We think a campaign works to associate ideas, positions, and values with a particular name. And a deceptive use of that name by opponents can undo all the work that the campaign has done. The current Minnesota campaign law does virtually nothing to prohibit deceptive use of names. If Minnesota voters want free and open and honest debate among active citizens, we think that deceptive use of names should be prohibited. The violations to that prohibition should be handled in the intense time frame of a campaign, so a special kind of court is needed. Representative Slawik's bill would prohibit deceptive use of names as a Chapter 211B violation. And 211B violations are heard by the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Office of Administrative Hearings is organized to act quickly in an election time frame, so it's exactly the right place for this to happen. It's also a court that's accessible to non-attorneys. Our group has had experience making a complaint about a campaign violation, and we didn't use an attorney, and we found we were able to be successful. So I think that's a very important part of how this bill is organized. I think the experience of Maplewood Voters Coalition demonstrates that the names of politically active Minnesotans are vulnerable to deceptive practices. So we urge you to support House File 255 to give individuals and groups like us a tool to defend our name, our brand, and our reputation so that voters can hear a free, open, and honest debate. Thank you.
Questions to Representative Fox?
Mr. Chair, I do need to clarify one thing. In the amendment, it does take out the word deceptively similar and clarifies that to may not use a name that is the same or similar to a name as previously used by any other candidate, political committee, or political fund with the intent to deceive. So I was slightly different than the amended version.
Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slawik, I guess I understand from the testimony what you're trying to get at here, but I have one question that we may not be able to answer today about whether this is even constitutional, but my other question is who determines whether a name is similar enough to invoke this law? How is this going to be policed? And isn't there right now a way for people to file complaints about these kinds of things?
That's so fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, right now the process and we is the Office of Administrative Hearings, from my understanding, I mean, through the campaigns that I've been involved with. In this particular case, and we do have our City Council member Don Nephew is up here, is it was involved in an election in Maplewood where they were using the name Maplewood Voters Coalition, and then another group came out using the name Maplewood Voters with very different messages. Right now, the need for the bill is a feeling that it isn't clear enough. Obviously, we don't want Steve Gottwald's committee. I mean, it isn't supposed to be after the person's name, so we're trying to get away from that. But as we all know, in campaigning, this can get very tricky, and that one of the ways people use negative campaigning is to try to use similar names and confuse the public. So right now, it is my understanding, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gottwald handled through the Office of Administrative Hearings, this just clarifies that if there is an intent to deceive, that would be the violation.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swalick, how is this going to be policed, and what are the penalties? I mean, how does this work?
If I may speak to that, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
As I understand 211D, any person, any citizen of the United States can bring an action based on a 211D law. They don't have to be personally harmed. If any person involved in the election or just watching the election feels that it's an inappropriate action, they can attempt to bring in a 211B complaint.
Representative Gottwald.
And Mr. Chair, to the testifier and to Representative Fall, can't they already do that? They can bring an action about these kinds of things right now, can't they?
Representative Fall, or
Mr. Chair, there is no provision in 211B that protects names. The only legal protection that I'm aware of is really copyright law and trademark law, which is state and federal law, and requires a whole different procedure of making an attempt to protect your name, where this is in the context of a campaign, so that it happens quickly and can be responded to quickly.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the situation that I encountered during my campaign would fall under this category here, where filed my campaign back in 07 and ended up the last day that you could file with the Secretary of State, another Sanders filed to run as a state representative in my district. So we had two Sanders on the ballot. And so in this situation, not one of the highs of the roller coaster of a campaign, as you can imagine. The question would be how would this bill take me through the process of how this would actually prevent, stop, or fix the problem.
Representative Fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, of course, we're going to have another Sanders run against you. That is obviously something that may happen to all of us. But if you have to look at carefully at the amendment when it talks about with the intent to deceive or cause confusion, I would think maybe the person wasn't running I would think they would be running a regular campaign if they didn't have the intent or to cause confusion or deceive. It would be rare to have a person with the same name that's doing that. It's really aimed at groups, and we all know that through our campaigns, there's a variety of group names that come out. So it's really, the intent is not to have this be against individuals. I suppose someone in the public could file a complaint about that, and then as the OAH would have to make a decision.
Mr. Chair, but in this situation, and in my situation, the candidate only threw up 6-yard signs, 4 of which were outside of the district. No campaign literature, did not fundraise. Is that not an intent to the argument to be made to be deceptive or to cause confusion?
Representative Slomick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, I don't think so. I think mine put up 10 lawn signs as well and had a different name. I mean, I think that sometimes people just don't work as hard as the other person. It all depends on how the candidate's working. This is really not aimed at individuals, and I really don't think that would apply. I don't think it's deceptive. I mean, by candidates are allowed to put up campaign signs and allowed, sounds like he was operating within the, he or she, within the confines of the law.
President Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, does this not apply to candidates?
Representative Fine.
It's Mr. Chair and Representative Sanders. It says may not use a name that is the same or similar to a name used previously by any other candidate, political committee, or political fund with the intent to deceive or cause confusion. I suppose, you know, Representative Sanders, in a way, maybe this would be a good thing for you to support, because then, you know, if someone felt that someone was filing against you from your committee or from the public, you could actually test this law out.
Mr. Chair, I just point out lines 1.8 and 1.9 of the amendment. This section does not apply to the use of a candidate's own name as part of all the candidate's name of a candidate's principal campaign committee. So, assuming that this truly was a Mr. or Ms. Sanders, this section would not apply. I suppose if they changed their name in order with the intent to deceive, then the first part would come into play.
Mr. Chair, thank you,
Representative Fowler.
Thank you, Representative Morrow.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was, though, is how do we, the intent of my question then is how do we go through the process of defining what intent is through this process, and kind of coattailing off of what Representative Gottwald was saying, is there already actions that can be taken? So I guess I'm asking for the process of how do we prove the intent then, because you do list by similar to a name used by a candidate. So you do list candidate there.
Mr. Chair, I'll answer and then I'll have Mr. Plister answer. I know in my own campaigns, and I've been, you know, my first ones were pretty close, is that you have to present both pieces of literature or both pieces of evidence and submit them to talk about what the complaint was and the wording. They made a decision based on what they saw, and then they it went on from there. You either had to pull your piece or do a piece that would rectify that. Mr. Plister?
Mr. Plister, you want to respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to get on thin ice, but there is substantial case law in the administrative Office of Administrative Hearings, most of which deals with one form or another of deception or whether someone is lying and that sort of thing. So I think the case law in OAH would be helpful in a particular action in defining what was intent and what wasn't.
Mr. Murray, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and at the risk of saying I am a lawyer and also teach First Amendment law, the showing of intent is a factual showing. It's a very difficult showing to show, especially when it comes to First Amendment rights. So one would have to produce evidence that the speaker in this case knew that they were being deceptive, that was their goal. Short of a confession or some other type of statement, it's a very difficult burden to reach, in part because of the great respect we have for the First Amendment. This simply says that if one were able to show that intent, then there would be a violation. But there are substantial 200-plus years of case law on what intent is when it comes to free speech and how that's proven.
Representative Stern.
Well, I just wanted to bring up, you know, the 21st century is more and more technology advanced, internet, and there's a registered political organization in my Senate district that used our own name in a website against it. So they've already have my name registered, and I don't know if this addresses anything about a website with, you know, someone else's name, and that seems very deceptive in that sense. So.
Representative Kalin, you're on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question either for Representative Morrow or for Mr. Gehring. I was along the lines that Representative Morrow just spoke. I think that the standard for intent with relationship to First Amendment speech rights is so rigorous that, especially with taking out the qualifier of deceptively and just leaving in the similar, I mean, same, I think you can make an argument that that the exact same name is clearly, I mean, that would be an easier factual determination. But I doubt that anybody would do that. Or if you would, it's just so, it's so patently obvious of an attempt to deceive that it's the similar names that are the really difficult. And I think that the instance that you're trying to respond to, as difficult and frustrating as I'm sure the experience has been and is in those situations, having had almost $100,000 spent against me and sort of looking at some of the pieces in the selection going, how the heck is that even close to true? The burden is on us as candidates to do the education, to do the work, and it is a very difficult burden to meet that factual determination. I'm just wondering if Mr. Gehring might have any comments to add to Representative Morrow's about whether we might ever find anybody that meets this standard to the point where this bill is, where if we were to make this law, that it would actually have an effect.
Representative Kalin, your initial statement was to Representative Morrow, and now it's to Mr. Gehring. Do you want Mr. Gehring to answer, or Representative Morrow?
I would prefer.
And thank you, Representative Morrow. That would be my preference.
I would like Representative Morrow to answer.
Mr. Gehring, would you please respond if you can?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I guess without having sort of research litigation where this exact language has been applied, I don't know sort of what the court would consider similar or not. I mean, as the witness said, you know, the Office of Administrative Hearings probably developed sort of case law and precedent on what they would take as a similar name or not based on cases that come before them. But beyond that, I guess I don't know, if there's a particular globe or universe of names that would definitely fall within this category.
Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in terms of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I think they can determine intent also. I mean, there is the opportunity to file a complaint, and I think we also shortchanged the voters a little bit. I think some of them are smart about these things. If I saw something like that, I think I'd probably figure out what was going on pretty easily, and I think the voters would too. But right now there is a process to file this complaint and for the Office of Administrative Hearings to determine if there was illegal intent, if there was something deceptive about the campaign practice. And I get the idea of trying to make it a little more explicit, but I too have the question about how this applies. What value does this add to the process right now?
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On another vein, to Representative Slawick, how far is the look back? I notice on line 1.9, you say is deceptively similar to a name used previously, and then it's blank. Representative Morrow mentioned that we've had over 200 years of case law. We have also had almost 200 years of election battles, right, with various organizations, various names. As I don't know how far one would have to look up to say a law-abiding citizen or campaign committee, and so that's my question.
Representative Sloan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Diskin, I'm not sure I understood the first part of your question. What is it exactly?
Representative Diskin, I think I'm going to refer that to Mr. Gehring. Maybe he can clarify. Mr. Gehring?
Chair, Representative Diskin, there isn't a specified sort of look-back period in the bill, although with the intent to deceive standard, you presumably would be okay if you happen to use the same name as a candidate from 100 years ago, but didn't do that with the intent to deceive voters. You do have to file for a campaign practices complaint. You have to file within 1 year of the deception.
President Tiffmeyer. Where did? Oh, I'm sorry, President Biskin. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question. First to the point about the intent to deceive, I guess I'd just be a little on shaky ground if I use words like change in my campaign rhetoric or committee. um, But for Representative Slawick, if an organization were to form and called themselves Citizens for Justice, right, and their primary plank was on releasing from prison people incarcerated for drug usage, right, would that be an intent to deceive?
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, the intent to deceive, I mean, just in this case it was the Maplewood Voters Coalition versus the Maplewood Voters. So when you say it's Citizens for Justice, I see. So deceiving may be based on a values concept. I think that that's not what we're trying to get at here. I think it's where people are actually using similar names and trying to see through that.
Representative Kissmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Forster, I certainly I appreciate the challenges that you went through and all of that. And, you know, we deal with that a number of times. But one of the things that the Office of Administrative Hearings, I don't know if some of you remember before that, and what you had happen here was politicizing of complaints. And the reason why the Office of Administrative Hearings process was initiated and created was to get at the crux of the issue, so that intent and some of those legal kinds of things that Representative Morrow referred to made a big difference, you know, that you had administrative law judges who could look at that. But the mere fact before, complaints themselves became a campaign tool.
Yes.
Okay? And so I can see something like this. Headline, so-and-so accused of deceptive names and the intent to deceive, and using this language in a political way, that would be a concern. And this can go either way. And so it's sometimes one of those things that, especially when the level of intent is so difficult, even for administrative law judges to take out of your heart and see what your intent was, usually they deal with things that are on the face of it. Similarities happen. And so I'm so sympathetic to you in those situations, but I don't know if this is going to fix it or make things worse and be used in a political way that you may not have ever intended, but could be done. And I remember those days. One wants to open up another door for that when the administrative office really does a very good job in most cases of getting us away from that. Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the problem I have with this bill is that it's hard to see someone should have a copyright on the use of the word Maplewood. And so it's hard, you know, the voters, I guess, were affiliated with Maplewood and so forth. The two cases that I know that I was involved in somewhat would not be covered by this at all. One of them was in my first race, which had four opponents originally, and it was at the time of the women's movement, and we were making a big pitch of, you know, getting another woman into the legislature, and suddenly, near the end of filings, the secretary of one of my opponents filed. Now, if that wasn't a blatant attempt to do it, I mean, the campaign just dealt with it by making sure people knew which woman they were going to vote for. The other one was a little more subtle. It was a Minneapolis Park Board race, where the incumbent, I may have these names slightly mixed up, but the incumbent had some name like Red Nelson in a district where Scandinavian names were a big pitch for on the ballot for the lesser elections down the ballot, and suddenly someone files called Uli Sweeney Carlson, with the parentheses, which who had never been known by that before, and so that then got the person with the non-Scandinavian name elected. So there are many ingenious ways one can do to deal with elections in this kind of thing. And sometimes just having to work harder or having to is probably the best way to do it. Probably easy to find a Saunders to run in a district, but might be a little harder to find a Slawick to do it. So.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to Representative Kahn and to the overall bill, this is why we have the First Amendment, why it's not easy to successfully bring an action for something like this, because you do want to encourage a robust exchange of ideas, even if they're deceptive. And this intent standard, I think, makes it very difficult to be successful in bringing any of these types of claims. I think the issue is, or the advantage of the bill, is that it creates a clear standard and may create something of a chilling effect on people who would try to use deceptive names in order to advance their cause. Mm-hmm. And to Representative Biskins, I guess I had an example, a counterexample to the Minnesotans for Justice, which would be whether a group that represents a small minority of people could be called Minnesota Majority.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Winkle, you're absolutely right. I concur. All right. And I also ponder whether or not the Taxpayers League can be prosecuted under this statute by the Taxpayers Association. So there's a lot of problems because of one small issue, and I realize for the people involved it wasn't small at all. It was a huge issue. Right? But in changing state law to deal with this specific issue, I think we better be real careful about what we do.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of a parliamentary question here. We have before us 255A1. What is the status of that amendment?
That amendment was adopted. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That amendment was not adopted. This is Representative Emmer's amendment. He is stuck in traffic, and he cannot make it.
So we're, Mr. Chairman, so we're, the A3 amendment is the author's amendment for the bill as introduced.
That's correct.
Thank you.
No further discussion. Do you have another person that wishes to testify, Representative Clark?
Chair Pawlowski and members, if you could very briefly, he was involved in the situation, and if you could very briefly testify, I'd appreciate it.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the
thank, rest. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. John Nephew is my name. I had a ringside seat to the events in this 2007 election. My interest in this amendment, though, is really not specific to that, but I think that that situation revealed a shortcoming in the 211B law that is a loophole easily exploited. So to my mind, this is closing that loophole. 211B.02 prohibits the false claims or implication of support or endorsement from individuals and groups. The situation that we saw arise was, in effect, to create a new group with a similar name to an existing group so as to make the claim of endorsement from that new group and confuse voters. And that is currently not, as I understand it, something prohibited by statute. So I think it's important to understand this bill, first of all, is working within the process of the OAH, which makes it very simple. If you file a frivolous complaint, it will not get past the prima facie stage where you submit the complaint and the OAH decides on the face of it whether there's an actual case or if it's just a harassing campaign ploy. And if there is a prima facie case, then they go to their probable cause hearing, and then ultimately they go to a hearing on the facts. An interesting situation in the 2007 election that Mr. Flitzer successfully pursued was that there was an organization that put out signs claiming that Maplewood Fire endorsed a candidate. And in the hearing, the people behind that, who happened to be paper call firefighters, but were not speaking on behalf of the fire department. Maplewood Fire is how the fire department identifies itself to residents of Maplewood, but Maplewood Fire had no standing for a claim of some sort. They said on the stand that their intent was that people would see those signs and believe that the Maplewood Fire Department was supporting this candidate. And so the OAH did rule against them and fined them $1,000 for a falsely implying support of an organization. The problem is that, and what we saw subsequently, was they began to register Maplewood Fire as a business name so that they could create an organization that would have the same name as what is commonly associated with another organization. So imagine the scenario where people, create the Ramsey County Board as a political action committee, B-O-R-E-D, and then put out campaign literature saying my candidate was endorsed by the Ramsey County Board. Well, I think that currently that would be legal. There would be no basis to complain about that, and that appears to be fair game, even though it seems to run afoul of the intent of 211B02, false claims of support. So, I also want to stress this is supposed to work within the OAH process, which I think works very well, and it's true that intent is a very high standard, but it is attainable in the cases where people are really trying to abuse the system in an effort to deceive voters. Thank you.
Representative Gumwalt.
Mr. Chair, I'll ask for a roll call on this.
Roll call has been requested. Seeing no further discussion, the motion is to have House File 255 as amended, recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Anderson?
No.
Diskin?
Nope.
Emmer? Gottwalt?
No.
Schulte? Hornstein?
No.
Hahn?
No.
Thielen?
No.
Kiffmeyer?
No.
Lanning?
No.
Marquardt?
No.
Morrow?
No.
Nelson?
No.
Hoppe?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Simon?
Aye.
Turner?
No.
Winkler?
Aye.
There being 14 nays and 2 ayes, the motion does not prevail. The bill is not going to be placed on the general register. The next bill on the agenda, that's your Representative Slawick. And Representative Slawick, we'll deal with your other bill at the next hearing. The next bill on the agenda is House File 300, Representative Dabney. Members, Representative Dabney talked to me prior to the hearing. He has a delete everything amendment, so our process on this bill is going to be, I'll make the motion on the bill, and then we'll put the delete everything amendment to the bill on, and then we're going to lay the bill over because of the delete everything amendment, so folks will have a few days to take a look at it because it significantly changes the bill. So, Representative Dabney, I'm going to move that House File 300 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register, and then you have an amendment. Representative Dabney, and you want to... I don't see the amendment here.
Mr. Chair, it's the HO300DE1 amendment. I know it's available back here on the table. I can't see
it. I will move the DE1 amendment, and out of courtesy to the author, let's put the amendment on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In consultation with Secretary of State's office here in the room this morning, I have a short oral amendment to the DE1.
Okay.
I thought you'd appreciate that.
Yes, Dabney. We're going to convert that into a written amendment, so why don't you slowly tell us what it is, and Mr. Gehring will take it down.
All right. Page 1, line 22, delete within A. Page 1, line 23, delete city of the first class. Page 1, line 23, delete the word mayor and insert the word governor. And page 1, line 24, delete the words mayoral and in that city.
Mr. Gehring, can you, first of all, tell us that you have the amendment and that this amendment actually works?
Mr. Chair, first, I think that it does work, and just to repeat the amendment on line 1.22, delete within A, 1.23, delete city of the first class, and also delete mayor and insert governor, and then 1.24, delete mayoral and in that city, so that paragraph D would read, for purposes of this subdivision, the two largest major political parties shall be the parties whose candidates for governor received the greatest and second greatest number of votes at the most recent election.
Right. Members, Mrs. Anderson, you have the amendment, and Mr. Gehring, you have the amendment. Then to this particular amendment, can you explain, Representative Dabney, why we're making that change?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Your previous bill, you visited the issue of unintended consequences. The Secretary of State's office was good enough to point out that the DE1 as drafted would have defined the two major political parties in Minneapolis as the DFL and the DFL. And even I was willing to give that there was a problem there. This, Mr. Chair, members, is the Republican channel.
All right.
The Green Party, Mr. Chair, is not a major political party in Minnesota. The Independence Party, however, is. So we've got three folks that potentially at bat here as opposed to one.
All right, members, I'm going to move this amendment to the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion failed. Now, the DE1 amendment is in the shape you wish to have it in, Representative Dabney.
Yes, it is.
I'm then going to move the DE1 amendment to House File 300. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is now in the shape you wish to have it in. We're going to lay it over till our next meeting so everyone can take a look at it. And then we will have it fairly near the top, Representative Dabney. So if you want to be here bright and early, you have one testifier, I believe, you want to bring that day. So
that's correct.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
House File 322, Representative Norris. I think I saw him come in. There he is. Representative Nornis, I believe this bill comes from education, and education wants it back once we've taken a look at it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that we're clear on that as yet. I think your staff is trying to determine that at this time.
Representative Nornis, that's what I was told, that we were to take a look at the education or the election portion of this, and then we were to send it back to education. But Mr. Gehring doesn't know.
But I
tell you what, we'll hold off on a motion until we're clear on that. Why don't you explain House File 322, and then we'll see what the motion is going to be. Okay, Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate the time this morning. House File 322 comes at the request of the Frazee School District, which is up actually in the very corner of my legislative district. And I share that with Representative Eakin and Representative Murdoch and so it's kind of right on the corner of all three districts. And the reason the legislation is here before us is that the Frazee School District struggled for a number of years to pass an excess levy referendum. And finally we're successful. Some folks in that district weren't happy with the outcome and found that they could petition to have another election. It's tough enough to have multiple elections. It's even harder when you're successful to have to look at another. It's expensive for the school district. It doesn't do anything for bringing a community back together again. And so we're here to make a slight change in current law in regards to revoking or reducing an operating referendum by petition. It would change the percentage of qualified voters from 15% to 30%, so it's raising the bar. And I have with me today the superintendent of the Frazee School District, actually Frazee Virgus, Virgus being the district that's in the school district that's in my district. And so we've been working jointly with the school district on this issue for some time. So we have the superintendent of the school, Frazee School District, Darren Stender, and he can explain further.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Darren Stender. I am the superintendent of the Frazee Virgus School District. I have been a superintendent there for the past 4 years. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to be here today to provide testimony in regards to the struggles of the district in securing a referendum and then also the struggles in the past year in trying to retain the referendum authority that the district so desperately needs.
All right. Any questions? Members, we're, the motion on this is going to be to refer it to finance. and it's got a couple of potential stops once it gets to finance. Representative Nornis, apparently taxes may also be interested in it. So
all right. I'm
going to move that House File 322 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to finance. And then they can deal with it from there.
All right.
Questions? Representative Marshall.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And this may also end up going to the Committee on Taxes also, since it certainly involves property taxpayers' rights. So I appreciate that motion. And I talked to Mr. Stender about this, and he's been a great advocate for this bill. I've had a few concerns on this, in that with the fact that what we're going to be doing with, you know, cuts to local government aid and county program aid, I mean, we're going to be seeing property taxes going up. And property taxes have really increased, and property taxpayers are taking more and more of a burden. So I always am somewhat reluctant to take property tax owners' rights away, which this would make it more restrictive. And the big question is, you know, why do you have these referendums? And it's because, you know, we're not probably keeping up with the funding for education, and I think that's the big issue. But school boards are able to, if they put up a referendum and it fails, they're able to come back and try to pass one with the normal vote of their board. And so I'm just wondering if the author, if in fact you're going to increase how difficult it's going to be to bring this up, if on a failed referendum, if you would entertain a school board having to pass like a two-thirds vote or a four-fifths vote to place another referendum on the table if it would fail the first time. My concern here is that you are you're making it more difficult for the property owner without any exchange on the other side. And I certainly understand the situation Frazee has had. I mean, there was many years of failed referendum attempts, and Mr. Stender's worked very hard on that. But I'm just concerned here that we're not really getting to the root of the problem, but that we're just piling on property taxpayers a little more in this type of a situation already. And those are my concerns.
President Narnas?
Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, I don't think we want to do anything to make passing a referendum more difficult. I think what you're suggesting would actually make it more difficult, and I think that would be a mistake. I agree that we shouldn't need to pass a levy referendum, but most school districts have, and in the years that Superintendent Stender has been in Frazee, I think he has dealt with this issue every year, and he's been a patient man, and it's been very tough. It really divides the community when you have referendum after referendum after referendum. It's very difficult just politically, and it's hard on neighbors. I guess I'm comfortable with the 30% number. When we have an election, generally that's the final outcome. And in this case, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the margin was about 60%.
That's correct.
It's a pretty significant margin in support of the referendum. And I believe also, you mentioned the district can do multiple. They can bring another referendum question back if the first one fails and so forth. I think each time they've had to change it to some degree. I know also the school district themselves, the teachers, superintendent, Stender, all stepped forward and took some pay reductions or pay freezes. They did kind of the extra mile to make this happen. So I guess where I'm coming from is that we don't want to take the right away, but we don't want to make it too easy to undo. This could spread across the state and be very detrimental to many school districts who operate only because the referendum passed.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to echo my friend's concern that there is no quid pro quo here for the taxpayers, that we are really stacking the deck for the school district. I am a representative that represents a school district that does not have an excess operating referendum, and they're still producing some quality education and quality results, so you can figure out how to do that. Now, I do have a question, Representative Normus. In your research, where would a 30% petition fall? Is that high? Is that average? Would this make it one of the most difficult recall position standards in the state for any other ballot initiative, or maybe even in the country? Do you know that?
Representative Nernis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vistens, I don't have an answer for that. I have not read the stats. I've just been trying to help one school district with what they consider to be a serious problem.
Representative Norris, I think Mr. Gehring may be able to help you here.
Okay.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, the 30% number, at least for purposes of the Minnesota law, would be, I think, the highest percentage that exists. The next highest number would be a 25% number if you're recalling a county officer, and the rest of the numbers are below that, between 1% and 5 and 10%.
Mm-hmm. Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one other question, Representative Nornes. Do you know how many successful recall petitions for school referendum have occurred in the last decade?
Representative Nornes.
Again, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Biskins, I do not. I'm guessing there's probably none.
No, we don't have that information either, but this bill has a few more stops, so that may come up.
We can find out.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Norton, looking at the existing law on page 1.12 and 1.13, we've got language saying that only one election to approve an increase may be held in a calendar year. I wonder if dealing with the timing, you know, I wonder if just a simple change to also include the petition for a decrease could not occur that close to the election. You know, taking that route. And I gather they get around it by just changing the words of the referendum, so maybe this is irrelevant.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Norton,
I think under current law that petition or the election for to undo a referendum can be done any time during the lifetime of that. Say it's a 10-year referendum. Uh-huh. They can attempt to do that any time during those 10 years. And I believe they have one chance. If it fails, that's the final. Maybe Superintendent Sender can clarify that even more.
If Superintendent Sender, do you wish to respond?
One question.
Well, let's okay. See if the Superintendent wishes to respond.
Yes, members of the committee. I think Mr. Norris is correct, and my understanding is that it's one opportunity. It has to go to the ballot. So, for example, the attempt this last fall does not count as that one opportunity. The one opportunity exists that actually has to be placed on the ballot and voted on by the residents of the district, either voted in favor of or against, and at that point it's no longer eligible to come back by a petition.
Mr. Chairman, so it failed to get the 15%, was that true, or it got the 15% and was on the ballot and failed?
Sender?
They did secure, they did have enough signatures to get the 15%. The board, we this went through the Supreme Court, this went through every level of administrative process there is, and we followed the advice of our legal counsel, which made the determination that the petition was insufficient in regards to the summary of the petition, and when you follow the rules and regulations of the petition, it's very clear in terms of the direction they want to go. We did send this to the State Attorney General's office to get an opinion from the office, which they sent it back to the district after a period of time and said this is a decision that needs to be made at the local level with no opinion provided.
Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornes and the Superintendent, I guess I would be more inclined to support this kind of thing if I saw it were a trend. To Representative Diskin's earlier question, in the superintendent's own testimony, if you want to look at the The page it mentions that, to my knowledge, this has only happened once in Minnesota, late 80s, early 90s, and was due to controversy over new legislation. Fortunately, the petitioners were unsuccessful, and the residents of the district kept their commitment. So this has never been, even at the current standard, it's never been used successfully to overturn a referendum. So I understand the concern and appreciate the process you've had to go through, but I wonder if this is kind of a bill in search of a problem.
Representative Nornes, you want to respond? Or?
Well, I don't. I think we've identified a problem, at least a potential problem, and again, the school district of Frazee came within just a whisker of having it on the November ballot. At a time, had that been on the ballot, had it passed, it would have been absolutely devastating to the district that had, you know, moved ahead with the assumption that they would have this additional money for those following years. And again, the superintendent maybe can comment more, but it was just due to a technicality that it didn't occur, and who knows what the outcome would have been. I think if the outcome had occurred and been negative to the school district, I think at that point you would have seen other districts in the state of Minnesota having folks decide, hey, there's something that we can do. Talk about property taxes. It would be a one direct way that they could say, okay, we'll fight this and lower our property taxes. To heck with the school.
Representative Turner.
Well, I just was going to ask a little more thought, like how they got to 30% as a thought. I mean, whether exploring the 20% or 25%, or what was the thought process and getting to that number for the change in amendment here.
Representative Nornes, our Superintendent Stender.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't think it was any scientific process we used to arrive at that number. Actually, to begin with, we were at a higher number. I think many were looking at 40%, and there might even be a bill over in the Senate that's actually at 40%. Personally, I'm the one that selected something a little more, call it a compromise. I thought 30% might be a better sell, knowing I had to come before committees like this one with that question. That 30%, I should add, is not in stone. It's not a magic number.
Representative Simon.
Hi.
No. Nope. Representative Caitlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two thoughts. First to Representative Gottwald's question. In North Branch, on a different issue, the city agreed to bond to build a new police station. By petition, it was subject to a reverse referendum and was defeated 2-1. It does happen, and I think it's a different situation than education, but you could argue that public safety and our schools are about as equally difficult to vote against, just from an emotional perspective. The second thought also involves the North Branch, but in this case it's the North Branch School District. We have been the lowest funded overall school district for, I think, 6 of the last 7 years in Minnesota. Congratulations on passing a referendum and being able to keep it on, Superintendent. We I don't believe, could do that. We need to fix the broken funding system in Minnesota. We have students in your district and students in mine that are subject to an opportunity gap, not an achievement gap, but an opportunity gap. And I don't serve on an election, on an education committee, and but wanted to point out that this bill may actually heighten the need for the bill that former Representative Frank Moe brought as an amendment, I believe, last year on the House floor, or certainly had introduced, to ban the use of operating levies to force the issue of having to do the funding reform that has not been substantively changed for 3.5 decades. We have students that we're not tapping into, and students that are being left behind. I would like to speak to offline Representative Nornes just about the 30% number and perhaps inconsistency looking at the constitutional number of 25% and talking about why that, you know, if we could
I'm along with Representative Biskins. I think I do share that concern that when we have so many different things in 15 volumes of statute, it may be easier to have consistency in numbers, but I'd like to talk more about that.
And I'd be open to that.
Yeah. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornes says a school board member chair, we went through a number of referenda, and I know that we would sit and wring our hands of why did we have to go to the voters in the cities and the counties to not. So I'm sympathetic, superintendent and representative, to the situation in which you found yourselves. At the same time, I'm very uncomfortable about picking a number that's a magic or not a magic number of 30%. I also wonder whether there might not be other ways to get perhaps the goal or at least one of the goals you want to get to. So I would be happy to hear more about where this bill might go in terms of the number. But I'm uncomfortable picking up such a, what I feel is a high number. In fact, it sounds like from Mr. Gehring, a higher number than any other standard we have for any other issue. And so that percentage makes me very uncomfortable.
Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Superintendent Stender, the referendum that was passed, for what period of time was that authorized with that vote?
Superintendent Stender. Yes, Representative Lanning, the period is for 5 years. Our district, in our five attempts, we've had everything out there from what we call the Minnesota Miracle, which is one of the lowest referendums proposed 2 years ago, was voted down overwhelmingly by our voters. We've tried multiple ballots. We've put every flavor you could onto a referendum to try to get the voters' interest and support to pass that referendum. So we went with 5 years. You know, we did listen to our voters. We called in the people that were not satisfied with what was going on. We had, I think in the course of a year, I had 18 different forums, community forums, and met with them, and we actually, and the time we called the Minnesota Miracle, that was designed by the very people who are trying to revoke our referendum authority now.
Representative Lanning.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm all for letting the voters weigh in on these issues. We can debate the threshold at which they should have to have a vote on an operating levy, but here we have a situation where the voters said yes. They would have another crack at it in 5 years. How many cracks do we need to let them have at this? I think this is a reasonable request, and to have the voters approve something and then a short time later undo it creates all kinds of havoc for school districts, and this is a reasonable request. We ought to approve it.
President Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is, I don't know if Superintendent Stender can answer, but the cost to the district of running one of these elections, and I think the crux of the issue is not so much whether it's successfully overturned after the voters just approved it, but the cost and expense of perpetually having to go back and fight these issues over and over again when a very small group of people, if well organized, can force that issue to keep coming back. There's an example in the Robbinsdale School District, part of which I represent, in which an outside political consultant from Iowa was hired to come in by a group of residents to try to defeat the referendum. And the guy basically has a cookie cutter political operation for killing these levy referendums. And we're getting to the point, I think, where these issues become more politicized. And organized opposition can, I think, begin to drag it down by just constantly firing arrows, even when the voters have made a clear statement. So the question is, what's the cost, and what is the impact, I guess, on the district of having to go through these?
Superintendent Stender.
Yes, I can answer that question. Our district has spent over $35,000 since 2004, either trying to secure a referendum or referendum, or trying to, as in last year, trying to defend the referendum. That's equivalent to one licensed staff member in our district.
Just a comparison, how many students do you serve?
We have about 1,000 students. Excuse me, I'm sorry. We have 1,000 students, K-12, and I'd like to, you know, here's the seriousness of this issue. It's difficult to secure a referendum. It's far more easier in looking at this, it's far more easier to revoke that or reduce it or lose your authority. In reference to the gentleman from Iowa, if he gets a hold of this and Frazee is the first school district that goes down, I have no doubt that there's 90% of the school districts in the state of Minnesota that are dependent upon 10 to 20% of their operating revenue of referendum authority. I have no doubt. I can name five schools off in the blink of an eye that will lose their referendum authority if Frazee is the first. They face that issue right now. I think the issue right now is there's a lot of voters out there that just are not aware of this 15% threshold, the opportunity to petition. They will be very well educated once it happens. And that poses, I think, probably the greatest threat to education when 90% of our school districts here and 13 school districts in the state are dependent upon that operating referendum.
Representative Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to belabor this point, but some would argue that the process works. Democracy is not a clean process. It's a messy process, and it's messy for a reason. Now, if the voters are saying over and over again they don't want the referendum, and they're saying what they will and won't do, that process is part of the democratic process. It appears to work fine so far in enacting a law at 30% or whatever it is, because we're afraid, concerns me greatly. And to Representative Morrow's comment, I would disagree with you. Taxes and counties do have to go to their voters. They have to go to their voters for a lot of things. I mean, our city certainly did. I don't know about other people's cities. That's part of the democratic process, is that you go to the voters. I'm willing to have a conversation about whether or not the threshold is small and being abused, but the evidence so far suggests that it's not. And that, in fact, even if you did have it, that means that it goes back to the voters. It doesn't mean that they automatically get it overturned. It means that it goes back to the voters. So I think we ought to move very carefully here, and I respect Representative Markwart's comments earlier about that. I share the concern. I understand that districts wanting a stable revenue stream, and that this may threaten it to a certain extent, but we should move very carefully here.
At the same time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll give you a philosophical, mathematical reason for the number of 30, which is the multiplication of the original number by its closest prime. And the but anyway, I think that I think this bill is a good idea. I think if it's going to finance and taxes, they can decide on what the number is. I imagine, Representative, if you want to have a number that already exists, I imagine Representative Nornes would happily accept 25, so I think we should just move it on, knowing that the tax people are going to be looking at it, too.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would concur with Representative Lanning that when a district passes a referendum like this and they gear up, maybe hire some staff, and then it puts them in a difficult situation if they have to look at possibly cutting staff in that short time. And just one other comment on petitions, and I'm not weighing in one way or the other on petitions, but I've seen petitions sitting on counters and gas stations and C stores, and sometimes people sign them and may not know what they're signing either. So we have to, I think, look at that once in a while, too, that sometimes petitions can be used in a way that may not be in the best interest.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornes. If I could refer you to lines 3.8 and 3.9 of the bill, what I would at least propose that you consider is, if the bill moves forward, my experience would be that the stability point that I think we just heard would be better addressed perhaps if not amending the percentage, but rather allowing a referendum that has been successfully passed to exist for perhaps half the life of the referendum. So if it's a five-year referendum, it can't be overturned in the first 2 or 3 years. I can leave that open to negotiation, but that would give at least the schools the ability to plan, to hire, to know that we have this money for at least X amount of time. So I would propose that you might look at line 3.8 to 3.9 and change the at least once perhaps to half the period of the referendum or some other quotient. I would be a little more comfortable with that. That would let voters have an idea of how the referendum has worked in the district rather than working with the number of voters needed to overturn the referendum.
Representative Simon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment along the same lines as Representative Morrow. I'm wondering, and I'm not proposing an amendment, oral or otherwise, but in a future committee, whether you might want to consider some sort of sliding scale. I was involved last year with a bill that had to do with charter commissions, and this is something that was thrown out or thrown around there, which is, you know, the higher percentage of the voters that vote in the affirmative, the tougher it is. Maybe that should be a variable standard, so that if 70% of the voters voted yes on the referendum, maybe the number should be higher. If it was 50% plus one, maybe it should be lower. That may be something you want to consider.
Right. Is there anyone who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Anyone else? No one else. Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 322 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee, where it probably has at least two stops. It looks like taxes and probably education finance now. So, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Poppy?
I would move the minutes of Wednesday, February 18, 2009.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, we will have a rather full agenda for next week. We have a number of bills that we're going to be recycling that were laid over, and we have also a whole array of bills coming. So with that, members, meeting is adjourned.